You're listening to the Charlottesville Podcasting Network at SevillePodcast.com. Lectures, radio shows, and more are available on demand at SevillePodcast.com. Now available through email. Sign up today. I'm Dan Gould. Award-winning historian and cartographer Rick Britton is a frequent guest on WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. In January and February of 2010, Rick presented 6 lectures in a new series entitled Characters of Central Virginia, The Famous, The Infamous, and The Undeniably Odd. The series was held at the Charlottesville Senior Center. In this podcast, you'll meet John Armstrong Chaloner. In a county famed for its wealthy eccentrics, Chaloner stands alone at the head of the class. He began his professional life well-educated, well-heeled, and well-connected. He became a poet, a novelist, a playwright, a patron of the arts, a philanthropist, and a dabbler in Eastern philosophy and the occult. Here's Rick Britton.
It was a bitterly cold March morning, but Richmond-based reporter St. George Bryan had a hunch that the long drive to the Mary Mills in Cobham, Eastern Albemarle County, would probably net him some juicy copy. After all, for more than a decade, the gossip columns had been covering the never a dull moment of the estate's millionaire owner. And Bryan sensed that this story, the police wire said that it was a shooting, would absolutely take the cake. He would not be disappointed. Crunching his vehicle through the driveway's ice-filled ruts, Bryan noticed several other news hounds already standing in the yard. A police sergeant, arms spread wide, keeping them away from the porch. He hit the brakes, swerved to a stop, and bundling his overcoat, rushed over to join them. "All right, you all right," the officer was saying with foggy breath. "The general says it's okay for y'all to come in, but make sure you don't touch anything." At the door, the newsmen were greeted by the owner's valet, a tall, slender man, very British looking. Following him down the hallway, St. George Bryan made a quick mental note of the numerous paintings and engravings with Napoleonic themes. They were suddenly in the dining room, and surprisingly, there the shooting victim still lay, chest down on the marble, a pool of drying blood providing a dark halo for his gnarled features. Beside him lay a heavy pair of fireplace tongs. "Good God," whispered the wide-eyed Bryan, absentmindedly fumbling in his pockets for a notepad. "Indeed," responded the valet, stepping around the body as the other reporters entered the room. "That is, or rather was, John Gillard, an Englishman, an employee of Mr. Chaloner's. He was a ne'er-do-well and a known wife-beater. Last evening, he and Mr. Chaloner had a tussle." Hurriedly scribbling down the particulars, Bryan lifted his eyes from the gruesome sight and noticed that they were not alone with the dead Britisher, for at the opposite side of the dining table sat the general himself, John Armstrong Chaloner. Wearing a pair of leather pajamas, the 44-year-old self-proclaimed psychic was just finishing up his customary breakfast of vanilla ice cream and duck. "I told you he was a character." "Morning, boys," he said, cheerfully looking up from his bowl, a meticulously curled Napoleonic forelock dominating his forehead. "I could have had the body removed, but I decided instead to spend the night with it here in the dining room just to test my nerve." "Your nerve seems pretty strong to me," answered one of the other newspaper men wryly. "That blood stain will remain on my floor as a memento," continued Chaloner, sounding as if he was reading a prepared statement. "I've already given orders that it not be washed out. I want to remember that in this room I have killed a man, not brutally, mind you, but in a just cause. I'm going to foot the bill for the burial plot and the funeral, of course, and I'm thinking of having Gillard's tombstone inscribed with the phrase, 'He died game.'" In a county known for its wealthy eccentrics, John Armstrong Chaloner stands alone at the head of the class. He began his professional life well-educated, well-heeled, and well-connected. He became a poet, a novelist, a playwright of sorts, and we'll talk about that a little bit later, a patron of the arts, a philanthropist, and a dabbler in Eastern philosophy and the occult. He believed he had special powers and could contact those beyond the grave. Challoner's bizarre behavior and weird writings were the source of cocktail party snickering for close to four decades. Virginia was his earthly tabernacle, wrote J. Bryan III, son of that newspaper man I was just quoting. But in spite of everything, he actually lived through the looking glass, a congenial neighbor to the Mad Hatter and the White Knight. Despite his many oddities, however, the general was loved by Albemarle County's poor and disadvantaged. It is doubtful whether we will ever see his like again. Challoner was born John Armstrong Chandler, C-H-A-N-L-E-R, in New York City, October 11, 1862. His father was a well-to-do Columbia professor. His mother, a great-granddaughter of fur magnate John Jacob Astor. An outgoing youngster, Chandler was known to his friends as Archie. Suiting the family's prestigious standing, he attended Rugby Academy in England, Columbia University, where he earned a master's degree in philosophy and psychology, and a degree in law, the College de France, and the École des Sciences Politiques. I guess that's the School of Political Science in France. Soon after the completion of his studies, Chandler was admitted to the New York bar. With his inherited fortune of $4 million, love of the arts, and membership in all the best clubs, 26-year-old Archie was distinguishable from other young New York patricians, wrote Bryan, chiefly for his ingratiating charm and intellectual energy. Other distinguishable characteristics, however, were about to emerge. In the spring of 1888, Chandler became engaged to the beautiful and talented Amalie Reeves, the wild child daughter of Colonel Alfred Landon Reeves of Castle Hill near Cobham in Albemarle County. The two were madly in love, but Archie's family disapproved. For starters, and think about the time, we're talking about over 100 years ago. For starters, Miss Reeves penned fiction of a very racy nature. Literature that was way past the acceptable in polite society. Secondly, she wrote Chandler into one of her tales. In Amalie's The Quick or the Dead, which appeared just before their marriage, one of the male characters named John bears a striking resemblance to her betrothed. He possessed, and this is right from Amalie's pen, he possessed curling brown hair above a square, strongly modeled forehead, eyes the color of autumn pools in sunlight, and a fine jaw which had that curve from ear to tip like the prow of a cutter. An unusual face, one in which every acquaintance would not be apt to recall hints of some friend or relative, would not be apt. Ah, but she was wrong. Archie's relatives did recognize that unusual face, and they were furious. The outraged chorus rose, wrote Bryan. Archie was denounced for awakening carnal thoughts. Amalie for entertaining carnal thoughts. Despite the objections, the couple was married at Castle Hill in June. Distressed by his family's intransigence in the matter, Chandler rewrote his will to exclude them, then sailed off to Europe on his honeymoon. The marriage was doomed from the onset. Back home in Albemarle County, Amalie returned to her writing, but she also began to prowl the woods at night, this according to Bryan, in a filmy white robe. Although she often lost herself and a servant nearly shot her, thinking she was a ghost, it would have violated Chandler's libertarian principles to restrain her or even challenge her conduct. When her next novel proved to be even more scandalous than The Quick and the Dead, Chandler faced up to the inevitable. They were divorced in 1895 on the grounds of incompatibility of temper. Amalie wasted little time. That same year, she married Prince Pierre Trubetskoy, a Russian artist who had been introduced to her by Oscar Wilde. And when you think that they were at parties with Oscar Wilde, you begin to understand the kind of society that they were traveling in. And the newlyweds, this is Amelie and her new Russian artist husband, took up residence at Castle Hill. Archie stunned the local gossips when he purchased the Merry Mills, a large estate but a short distance away, in fact, just across the highway. On the outside, the three became and remained close friends. But on the inside, John Armstrong Challoner felt other forces stirring. In December 1895, and this is directly from Archie, in December 1895, I was playing billiards when I noticed that the balls broke in a strange manner, suggesting a map of the heavens. I broke them again and then a third time, and in each instance, in a similar manner, they formed circles and curves. He reached for pencil and paper. When I attempted to draw a billiard ball, my pencil failed to obey my will and instead wrote three words, "Get a planchette." Used for automatic writing or spirit messages, these devices are small triangular boards mounted on rollers and holding a pencil that moved with but a light touch of the fingers. The first word Archie transcribed from the great beyond proved lucrative, a stock market tip which netted him a quick $600. I told you it was a character. "Stand by the window facing west," the board next told him, the planchette, "and with a mirror in one hand and your pearl pin in the other, watch the change in your eyes." For the rest of his life, Chandler would claim that within 15 minutes, his eyes transmogrified from brown, the color of autumn pools, as Amelie had written, to a very dark gray. More spirit revelations, thanks to his newfound X-faculty, as he called it, came fast and furious. He had been granted animal magnetism, he claimed, for example, that allowed him to will the heavy curtains in his library to hang 6 inches out of bias. And the planchette told him that he was Napoleon Bonaparte reincarnated. Surprise, surprise, huh? Taking this to heart, Archie began enhancing the already existing resemblance by curling a forelock, wearing period getup, and striking the familiar hand-in-jacket pose. He started passing out small busts of himself and the emperor, and at times wore a sword to bed. Now, that could be kind of dangerous. When news of this strange behavior reached his family, brother Winthrop Chandler made a trip to the Merry Mills. His appearance, unannounced outside of Archie's bedroom, was most unwelcome. According to the accounts, brother Winthrop was summarily kicked down the staircase. In response, brother Robert Chandler declared publicly, "He's loony," a statement he would later regret, and the powerful family got together and decided quickly to take action. In February of 1897, celebrated architect Stanford White, along with a man he introduced as an occultist, visited the Merry Mills and invited Archie up to New York. "What about a plunge in the metropolitan whirl?" tempted White. In the city, Chandler took a room at the Kensington Hotel on Lower Fifth Avenue. There he was visited again by the supposed occultist and a consultant who was actually Dr. Moses Allen Starr, professor of nervous diseases at Columbia. On March 13th, Starr returned with two policemen and a warrant stating that Chandler was prone to hallucinations and incapable of managing his own affairs. At the moment of their arrival, Archie was laying on his back, awaiting his transformation, as foretold by the planchette, into the perfect death mask image of Napoleon Bonaparte. For the next 3.5 years, Chandler was an inmate of the Bloomingdale Asylum in White Plains, New York. The doctors there claimed he was a dangerous lunatic. "Why do the doctors here not discharge me as sane?" Chandler wrote Charlottesville Commonwealth's attorney, Micaiah Woods, remember him, the father of Maud Coleman Woods. Archie wrote to him on July 3rd, 1897. "Why? Because the duty of the doctors in this private insane asylum appears to be to hold anybody placed here long enough for the owners to make a good profit out of him. Times are hard. It is not every day that the proprietors can capture a prisoner who can be made to pay $100 a week ransom. That is the exorbitant sum I am forced to pay in exchange for a two-room cell, a keeper, and baked potatoes. While at Bloomingdale, Chandler composed reams of sonnets. He claimed as many as 500, many of which he later published in a yearly entitled Scorpio. The first stanza of Alec in Wonderland reads as follows. I read a lot of his stuff, and I felt like it wasn't enough just to tell you about it. I actually had to let you see how god-awful it is. I was enticed to a stranger town, a vasty city full of bricks and stones, of avenues that run straight up and down, and houses filled with lies and dead men's bones. I there was seized and into dungeon thrown, set into life, sentenced to life imprisonment to die, to there remain till my poor soul had flown. John Armstrong Chandler flew the coop, soul and all, on Thanksgiving Day, 1900, by eluding his keeper and simply walking off the grounds. The police bulletin described the 38-year-old escapee as wearing a black fedora hat, a navy blue Melton overcoat, steel gray trousers, and a black satin tie with a large gray pearl stick pin. He holds himself erect, it continued, walks with a swinging stride, and of course, carries a cane. Archie disappeared from the public eye for most of a year, but then he came back swinging. He had sought help from Philadelphia Dr. J. Madison Taylor, a personal physician to Joseph Pulitzer and Theodore Roosevelt. After a six-month battery of tests, Taylor and other neurologists agreed that Archie was sane. With their help, Chandler was granted legal sanity in the Old Dominion in November of 1901. His status was now rather unique, wrote Bryan. Sane in Virginia and later in North Carolina, but mad elsewhere. He could not leave these states without risking his freedom. No problem. Chandler was content to celebrate his victory at the Merry Mills in Albemarle. I was sent to an asylum because I made new discoveries in experimental psychology, Archie boasted to a reporter from the New York Journal shortly after his return. I have suffered for my scientific discoveries. It was during this period that he terminated what little remained of the relationship with his family and changed his name to Challoner, C-H-A-L-O-N-E-R. And I have to admit, it's a lot easier to pronounce Challoner than it is Chandler. Back home in the Old Dominion, Archie was soon up to his old tricks. In Richmond, he became famous for using his heavy walking stick to fracture the windshields of automobiles he imagined to be driving too close to the curb. And somehow he gained admittance to the city's prestigious Westmoreland Club, where his arrival seemed to always remind the other members that they had other appointments. Veterans who had faced a Yankee battery point blank, penned Bryan, refused to face a lone man who dined only at noon and midnight and usually on a quart of ice cream and a dozen baked apples. At the Merry Mills in Albemarle, Challoner's schedule was just as unusual. He would normally rise at 11 a.m., ride horseback for a few hours, then answer his correspondence, eat a single meal around midnight, and read in his bedroom until retiring at 3 a.m. With all of his usual peculiarities, it's extremely fortunate that Archie Challoner abstained from alcohol. Total abstinence is part of the diet system that evidently keeps this man in such good condition. Noted the New York Herald in 1906, he is 5 feet 10 1/2 inches in height, weighs 165 pounds, so fairly thin, has curly hair that is combed with a side part, giving an artistic odd appearance, and a clear steel gray eye that he contends was once brown. Naturally, the shooting incident at the Merry Mills in 1909 was the talk of Central Virginia. It also appeared on front pages all across the United States. Challoner had given John Gillard work at the Merry Mills and a place to live, but the Englishman was a drunkard and frequently beat his wife, Annie. Fed up with this abuse, on the evening of March 15th, Annie gathered her children and ran to the protection of Challoner's home. Mr. Gillard was hot on her trail, storming into the dining room and loudly demanding an explanation. Gillard grabbed a silver fork and stabbed his wife so violently that it bent the utensil. Then he went after her with the fireplace tongs. Annie's screams brought Challoner, a friend named Ernie Money, and a servant rushing in to the rescue. While the two others subdued the blackguard, Challoner kept him covered with his pistol. Enraged, Gillard lunged forward, reaching for the gun. There was a scuffle and bam, it went off. The Englishman fell to the marble with a bullet in his brain. The following morning, Archie showed off the dead man as if he were a hunting trophy. When one of the newsmen offered his sympathy, the general was amazed. "Sorry for me? I'm all right," he responded, pointing to the floor. "There's the man to be sorry for." Challoner was absolved from any wrongdoing by a coroner's jury. In 1910, Archie uttered the most famous phrase of his entire life. 3 years earlier, his brother Robert, upon the occasion of his first divorce, had vowed that his next wife would be the most gorgeous woman on the planet. Robert Chandler was the swashbuckling sheriff of Dutchess County, New York, and apparently just another pea from the same old Chandler pod. He used his seven-figure inheritance to publish a private magazine and was fond of painting bizarre portraits and hosting strange and very wild parties in his 47th Street studio. Enter Lena Cavalieri, the Metropolitan Opera's new soprano, a curvy seductress billed as the most beautiful singer in the world. Can you see where this is going? Lena and Robert were married only a few months after their first meeting. 2 weeks later, the fickle songstress rushed back into the arms of her previous lover. She left behind a trail of tears, but also signed documents. When Archie learned that his sheepish brother had forked over his entire estate, minus a mere $30 a month allowance, he howled in delight. Here was his opportunity to repay the "he's loony" comment from 1897. "Who's loony now?" Challoner fired off to his lovesick brother. The newspapers and the nation, as you can imagine, had a field day. Within a fortnight, urchins on the street were shrieking it, hackmen were bandying it, and dignitaries murmuring it, wrote Bryan. On stage, comedians used the three-word phrase to demolish their straight men, and it even appeared in the funny pages. "Who's loony now?" Mutt demanded of Jeff, with what had quickly become the year's eternal question, and the phrase endured. In 1932, Franklin Delano Roosevelt used the remark to counter rumors that he was considering a pre-inaugural tour of England. "Who's loony now?" And in the 1950s, Richmonders could be heard singing "Who's Loony Now" to the tune of Connie Francis's hit, "Who's Sorry Now?" Chandler began his writing career, as noted above, while incarcerated at Bloomingdale. Once released, he went at the typewriter with a passion, eventually producing some 21 books, all of which were printed by the Palmetto Press of Roanoke Rapids, North Carolina, with, as you can imagine, Challoner footing the bill. His demand for lunacy law reform, 4 years behind the bars of Bloomingdale, or the bankruptcy of law in New York, that's his title, 4 years behind the bars of Bloomingdale, or the bankruptcy of law in New York. This was published in 1906. Scorpio, which beginning in 1906 appeared yearly, gave him an outlet for his asylum-scrawled sonnets, drivel that attacked everything from his family, and here's a quote from one, "with seven brothers and sisters, I am cursed." You can imagine where that one would go. To even George Bernard Shaw and the Metropolitan Opera. One Scorpio reviewer, and I just had to include this, I love this. One Scorpio reviewer called it, quote, "anchovy paste on the buttered toast of our literature." Has anybody ever had anchovy paste? It's terrible. In his 1915 play entitled Robbery Under Law, Chaloner made no attempt to disguise himself as Hugh Stutfield of Rokeby, Albemarle County, Virginia, and New York. Stutfield, in the abysmally sappy story, is a millionaire art patron and law writer who kills a drunken Englishman, John Bullard, in his own home. The following year, Archie banged out three books, a sonnet sequence entitled English Bards and Scotch Reviewers, and two dramas, The Serpent of Old Nile and Saul. His masterpiece, however, first hit the bookstores in 1916. And here's the title, Hell, Per a Spirit Message Therefrom Alleged, and The Infernal Comedy. It's a 400-page volume detailing Satan's dominion as described to Chaloner by a deceased friend, Thomas Jefferson Miller, once a commissioned officer in the Confederate States Navy. The devil, stated Miller through the method of automatic writing, is a man of medium height whose face is that of Napoleon Bonaparte at the apex of his power, and whose the rest of his body appears like Michelangelo's statue, The Thinker. The walls of his audience chamber, claimed the dead Confederate, are constructed of rubies the size of ordinary building bricks, and in place of mortar, we have diamonds as large as your thumbnail. The floor is of marble and has the marvelous quality of taking on the color of whatever stands upon or flies over it. Thus, if a cherubim flies over the floor space, the marble tints become red. If, on the other hand, a seraphim crosses the space, the marble tints become cerulean blue. Despite this communing with dead acquaintances, strange eating habits, and strange behavior, Archie Chaloner was quite a philanthropist and much loved by the people of Albemarle County. During his lifetime, he created the Chandler Art Prize, funded the Chaloner Theater in New York, and made many grants to Columbia University and to the University of Virginia. In 1927, Chaloner made a generous gift to Jefferson's University that paid the expenses of an expedition to Norway to observe a total eclipse of the sun. He was known to lend money freely, wrote David A. Marr in the Daily Progress, and pay needy people's rent, doctor, and grocery bills. Huge parties were frequently staged at the Merry Mills. The largest of these, sometimes attracting as many as 10,000 persons, wrote historian John Hammond Moore, usually occurred on the 4th of July, and they were truly a community affair, complete with movies, food, games, bands, fireworks, perhaps a performing aviator or two, and speeches, one always by the host himself, of course. These wonderful kindnesses led the people of Central Virginia to refer to him affectionately as the general. His most famous act of philanthropy, however, was his 1920 construction at the Merry Mills of a movie theater that could seat 300. Farm population had declined in the first two decades of the 20th century. Chaloner's answer to the problem was to provide free entertainment. This facility, according to Moore, soon became a mecca for scores of farm families in eastern Albemarle and neighboring Orange and Fluvanna counties. There they not only saw comedies and news, but educational films as well. And that education went a big step further, achieving at the Merry Mills something that would take the outside world another two generations. At Chandler's Theater, black and white folks sat side by side, enjoying the same show, not separated. The Columbia, Virginia State reported in November of 1921 that Archie's theater drew folks like a mustard poultice. The rich and the poor all come, Chaloner told the New Orleans Times-Picayune the next year. One little boy and his sister walked 16 miles to attend the movies on one night. That shows how hard up these folks are for a bit of amusement. Archie's movies for the farmers failed to halt the local rural exodus, but it was a huge success, in that it was a bright spot in the lives of many hardworking people in Albemarle County. John Armstrong Chaloner, the man who popularized Who's Loony Now and made countless outlandish claims, died at UVA Hospital on June 1st, 1935. He was 72 years old. Challoner is buried in Grace Episcopal Church Cemetery, but a short distance from the grave of John Gillard. Outrageous and flamboyant in life, the general's headstone is inscribed with the simple, "Blessed is the man who considereth the poor and the needy." During his funeral service, 40 black neighbors sang "Swing Low, Sweet Chariot." Thanks.
For the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, I am Dan Gould.